paranormal experiences don't really work to a timescale, and therefore, we invite you to listen to a dark minisode. Hello everyone and welcome to the final minisode of season 20. And I think I've said on every episode just how unbelievably fast season 20 has gone. But I think I haven't said enough of just how much this season has meant to me. It's really reignited both my passion for the paranormal and for podcasting. And that's all down to you. So genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all the support, feedback, and of course, experiences that you've provided for season 20. Now, of course, we put our sights on season 21, so therefore, if you're sitting on an experience, regardless of length, because remember, we need to not only fill the dark paranormal episodes, we have minisodes, we have dark bites, and the length of your experience, as we say on Dark Bites, should not be indicative of how terrifying or how truthful that experience is, nor does it mean it should not be shared with others. So, please either click in the link in the show notes or go direct to thedarkparanormal.com and click on Submit My Experience. Now, of course, with this being Wednesday when you're hearing this, that means you have 2 more days up until midnight UK time on Friday before we remove access to a 3 weeks trial of our highest tier on Patreon, which will give you a full week to go and binge through the back catalogue of Dark Bites, which will make the break in seasons a little less empty of the dark paranormal. Again, you can follow the link in the show notes or just go direct to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal. But right now, we have our final dark minisode of the season. And it's an email from Colette, who splits her experience into kind of 5 chapters across this minisode. We've chosen Colette's email to be our final minisode, as there are multiple layered elements within her experiences that subtly imply a powerful echo of a recurring, inescapable pattern. And so please, sit back and enjoy our final minisode, A Dark Generational Loop. Hey, my name is Colette. I love your podcast and I listen all the time. I started listening to it a couple of years ago when I was going through a really rough patch with my OCD and family issues. Basically, my insomnia became that bad I was on really heavy prescribed sleep medication for 6 months, and your podcast, I swear, helped me come out of it. I remember the first day of relief that I had from anxiety was listening to your podcast. And that started this feeling inside of me of like, okay, everything is going to be okay. And I remember I actually fell asleep for the first time without medication listening to your podcast. And that's not an insult. Haha. I was listening to it for hours and then fell asleep at 5 a.m. I fell asleep because I started thinking about the story you were telling, not my sleep. So I have a few different stories that eventually all come together. The first part is about me. The second is about my maternal grandfather. Use whatever you'd like, except if I say specifically not to. If you share this on your podcast, please give me the name Colette. I just want to be anonymous. Well, thank you so much for the kind words, Colette. And in case you haven't noticed, by me calling you Colette, we are going to use your experience. Now, I should point out that the eagle-eared amongst you may well have picked up on the sound of birdsong or birds tweetering in the background of the earlier part of this show, and that's because the UK is having a bit of a heatwave, my studio is currently at 38 degrees as it's in the attic of the house, and therefore I've had to relocate the studio as a mini studio on the landing where it's much cooler. That being said, there is a TV channel that I have on for the cat, because I'm that way inclined, which is just birds playing around. So I've just lowered that, which will hopefully allow you to immerse yourself more in Colette's experience, which we will begin now. I guess I should start with my own experiences. So to give some context, I have severe OCD. I currently work as a cancer researcher at a US top 10 hospital. I also am at a very highly regarded institution for grad school. None of this is to be egotistical. Honestly, I share this because I want to be trusted, because this is all true. And I'm a very deeply rational, logical person. Honestly, sometimes to a fault. Firstly, I'll mention my nightly ritual. The first experience started when I was a child, probably between the ages of 6 and 8. Every night, before falling asleep, I'd pull the covers over my head and imagine two men standing at my bedroom door. One was a short, heavy-set man holding a hammer. The other was tall and thin. I'd repeat a scene in my head and talk out loud every night the following words. Should we kill her? I don't know, but I'm ready to do it. No, not tonight. Let's do it tomorrow. They always decided to leave, or at least that's how I'd voice it out. I did this every night without fail for years. At the time, I just thought it was part of my OCD, a kind of ritual I had to do to fall asleep. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. I'll let you and the listeners decide, as you'll see my grandpa's experience and my theories at the end. I'll now talk about my coma. Fast forward to when I was 18, and I just moved to a major city to start college. Within my first week, I developed a severe lung illness, and I deteriorated so quickly that I was put on the lung transplant list almost immediately, which is something that can take years. I was intubated and placed in a medically induced coma for a week. What they don't tell you about medically induced comas is that you're not always fully under. The drugs make you sleep, but you can still wake up intermittently. So, I'd wake up briefly, cry, then drift off again once the nurse gave me more sedation. During those waking moments, I remember feeling a tube in my throat and tape across my face. My arms were tied to the bed, which is standard to prevent patients from pulling out the lines. I'd lift my head slightly, register my surroundings, and then fall back asleep. When I'd fall back asleep during sedation, I'd have a reoccurring dream. In it, I was lying in a hospital bed in a completely empty room. I'd somehow managed to undo my restraints and remove all the medical tubes from my body, over 10 of them, it turns out, and I somehow knew where each one was, as I learnt later on, even though I had no way of seeing them whilst awake. Then I'd swing my legs over the side of the bed, stand up, and walk out of the room. I'd always turn left into a long, dark hallway, deep blue and black in colour. At the end of the hallway stood a figure, a tall, shadowy silhouette man in a trench coat and top hat. He had no eyes, but I could feel him looking directly at me. I wasn't afraid, the air just felt melancholy. Each time I slept, this same dream would repeat. We'd stand there, staring at each other, until I'd wake up to be put under again. The only dream that was different happened in the home of a family I used to babysit for in high school. They had 4 kids, of which Jake was the eldest, and Tanya was the second eldest. In the dream, I was walking up the stairs looking for Jake, and Tanya is sitting on the landing. "Where's Jake?" I ask. She looked at me and said, "He's not here anymore." And then I go round the house searching, and he was never anywhere to be found. Years later, Jake died in a car accident. Now maybe that's coincidence, but I've never had a dream like that before or since. Eventually, I came out of the coma, and I received further treatment. Miraculously, I didn't need a lung transplant. My lungs healed fully, so much so that a decade later, doctors could see no lung scarring on x-rays. After being discharged, I stayed with some close family friends, Kate and Ben, who had visited me many times in hospital. And Kate told me something strange. When she visited, she refused to go into my room. "I just couldn't go in," she said. "There was something really evil and dark that I felt next to your bed." Now, I didn't tell her about the Shadow Man, but I thought to myself, I saw him in my dreams because I was always asleep. But maybe he was actually in my room. Years later, I finally decided to look up the figure I'd seen in my coma. The tall, dark silhouette with the trench coat and top hat. I'd put it off for a long time because, honestly, I didn't want to know. It freaked me out too much. But one day, I was reading a story from a nurse about a patient near death, who looked up and said, "Don't you see him? He's standing right there." And he went on to describe the exact same figure that I'd seen. At the end of the story, the nurse mentioned something named the Hat Man. That sent me down a rabbit hole, and I learned that this figure has been reported all over the world, usually during moments of trauma, illness, or sleep paralysis. Some people find him terrifying. Others, like me, just feel a strange heaviness or sadness. But the most unsettling part was realizing this wasn't my imagination. It was a known phenomenon. As an added side note, I had never, in all the scary movies and books that I'd ever read, came across anything like Hat Man. So this was not my imagination. I know that for fact. Now I'll move on to my grandfather's experiences. A few years after my grandmother passed away, my grandfather stayed in the house they had built together. Now this was a big house, and I'd spent a lot of time there growing up. It had 4 or 5 bedrooms, a huge yard, and all the stuff my grandmother had collected over the years, especially Native American art and jewellery, which she loved. We do have a little bit of Native American ancestry in our family. Not enough to claim identity or anything, but she always had a deep appreciation for the culture. After she passed, my grandfather stayed there alone for a while, which was always a bit strange to me, just because the house was so big. My mum told me he might be starting to show signs of dementia, but he was still reading medical journals and having sharp conversations whenever I would visit. Then he started telling my mum about some odd things happening in the house. At first, it was footsteps upstairs, really loud, really fast, like someone in boots running back and forth. Next, it was children's voices outside his bedroom window in the middle of the night, laughing and playing. But there were no kids nearby, and definitely none out at night. Later, he said he'd felt something hold onto his ankles and pull hard whilst he was lying in bed, as if it was trying to drag him from bed. He said he'd had to hold on to the headboard and yelled, "Would you knock it off?" And then it would stop. He also said he sometimes would hear my grandmother calling him from somewhere in the house, or he'd catch a glimpse of her tan cashmere sweater turning a corner. He wasn't scared by most of it, just kind of bothered or confused. He even said he'd seen this old red rubber ball from our childhood, one my sister and I used to play with. It had been thrown out years ago, but every now and again he'd say he'd see it rolling down the hallway towards him, and when he'd go to pick it up, it would disappear. Eventually, though, he saw something that really scared him. He described a tall, dark woman standing at the end of the hallway, wearing a trench coat and a hat. When my mum told me this, I thought, that's so like the man I saw in my dreams when I was in a coma. Looking into it, I found out that this figure known as Hat Man sometimes shows up in families, as if he follows a bloodline. It's also common for him to appear when someone is close to death. But what hit me most is this. My mum told me that my grandfather had started seeing two men appear at his bedroom door at night. One short, heavy set, holding a hammer. One tall and skinny with a bag. He said they'd stand there, deciding whether they were going to kill him or not. I just sat there, thinking, wait, me too. This was the exact thing I used to imagine as a kid. The same figures, the same dialogue, and I'd never told anyone about it before. I'd always thought it was some weird OCD ritual. Apparently not.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Next, I will talk about when I visited the house. So during COVID, I visited the house with my now husband, we were dating at the time, and I wanted to show him where I'd spent much of my childhood. Everything in that house was still in the same place. The rugs, artwork, all of my grandmother's collections. But the second we walked in, something felt different. The lights were on. The temperature was the same, but it just felt darker. My grandfather was in the kitchen, totally himself. Talkative, sharp, friendly. That part felt normal. Then I decided to take my boyfriend upstairs to show him the room where my sister and I used to sleep when we visited. And that's when things got strange. A very quick layout explanation, but when you walk upstairs, which are near the front entry of the house, you'd reach a landing. Immediately to the right is the attic door. If you go left, there's a long hallway with 3 bedrooms and a bathroom. The room at the very end of the hall is my mum's childhood room, the one my sister and I always used. Directly next to that, on the left, is my uncle's old room. And across from his room is a full bathroom that's actually connected to my mum's room by a second door. So those rooms form a little loop. As soon as we stepped into my mum's old room, we were hit by the sight of dead flies. I mean, thousands of dead flies. They were everywhere, stuffed into the windowsills, piled into the corners, and tucked into the cracks of the floorboards. Thousands, I mean thousands. You could have filled a bucket or 12 with them. I walked into the bathroom, the same thing. Flies, everywhere. But what made it really weird was how localized it was. The hallway outside that room, clean. My uncle's room, right next door, not a single fly in sight. You could touch the doors to both rooms at the same time. They were that close. All the doors were also open. Yet all the flies were concentrated in my mum's room and the bathroom connected to it. That's when my boyfriend, a very logical, rational, not interested in the paranormal mathematician, I might add, looked around and said, "Something here wants us to leave. Seriously, something owns this room." At first, I was annoyed. I grew up in this house. This felt like a personal insult. But even I had to admit the room felt off, especially when I realized that my mum had been sleeping in that room to keep my grandfather company. If she'd been sleeping there, wouldn't she have cleaned out the flies? Something just didn't add up. It was just bizarre. Just then, my mum yelled for us to come downstairs loudly. So we ran back downstairs, I pulled her aside, and honestly, I reprimanded her. I was mad she let my grandpa stay in a house that was so dirty. But we never talked about the room she was sleeping in, the room with the flies, ever. The fifth part is what happened after. Eventually, my grandpa moved into a retirement home. When the house was being sold, the new owners wanted some updates, as in new paint, shingles, basic stuff. But the people hired to do the work started quitting. A painter said he lost his balance whilst working on stilts. And just before he was about to fall, he felt two hands push him back towards the wall. He was so scared, he quit that moment and never came back. Other workers said they kept finding animals stuck in the chimney. Birds, squirrels, bats. It reminded me of my childhood, because there were always random animals getting stuck in the house. One time, a squirrel got into the oven ventilation system. Another time, my dad had to come over in the middle of the night to catch a bat with a robe. It was constant, honestly. Eventually, the new owner walked over to my mum's house and asked if my grandma had passed away in the house. My mum said, no, she died in a hospice. The woman just said, "Oh, okay. I was just wondering because, well, things are happening over there." That's all she said, at least to my knowledge. I have some final thoughts. I have one theory. It actually might be tied to the land. When the house was being built, a neighbour told my grandma that the land may have been a Native American burial ground. My grandma believed it, especially after they kept digging up coins whilst installing the sprinkler system. She showed them to me once, stored in a little Tiffany box labelled coins. They were odd. Definitely not modern coins, with holes in the middle, and markings I was unfamiliar with. Later, I learned that some plains tribes, like the Cheyenne and the Lakota, used to pierce coins to wear as jewellery or to sew onto clothing. That practice was common in the late 1800s to early 1900s, and those tribes were present in parts where we lived, especially in the eastern and central regions. I also found out that while holed coins weren't typically used in Native American burials, they were commonly worn as jewellery, or, as I say, sewn onto the clothes by these tribes. So even if it wasn't burial ground, it's likely the land had been used or passed through by Native people. Whatever was in that house had been on that land/house for a long, long time. When my grandma was alive, I think she kept it in check. She had a very strong controlling energy, and nothing big ever really happened when she was around. Even if the house always had a slightly spooky feel in certain spots. Whether it's the land, something that follows the family, or both, I don't know. But the two men my grandfather and I both saw, and the hat man, showing up like that just makes me think there is something deeper going on. As a side note, with the two men myself and my grandpa experienced, I didn't experience those men in his house, so they are not tied to the land. It was in my house, and my grandpa experienced them in his, which is why it's so weird to me. Colette then shares three theories when she's been looking into potential reasons behind what took place, and three of them we will cover here. However, how they were gained, we can't use the exact wording, but we're all slightly familiar with the terminology that we'll use. The first is a tulpa, a thought form. We've covered them before on many episodes, and it's the theory from Tibetan mysticism that a tulpa can be created by repeated focus, imagination, and belief. So when you, for example, the initial story when it came into Western culture, I believe, was when a British explorer was staying with some Tibetan monks, and he says he witnessed them create a tulpa to help them clean up the camp. However, in their experience, this tulpa kind of broke rank, would no longer take their commands, and they needed to do a banishing ritual in order to get rid of what they'd created. Now, from Colette's experience, she literally refers to her nighttime ritual that she performed for years. There is an argument to say that very act may have created this hammer-wielding, heavy-set man and his thin accomplice. And we could say, well, the granddad didn't, so why is he involved in that in any way, shape or form? But again, like the origin story in many situations regarding tulpas, this Englishman who went to Tibet, he had no part in that ritual. Yet he witnessed firsthand the effects of this tulpa. So once the tulpa has been created and was allowed to be given free rein, so to speak, it doesn't seem too much of a reach that they would also visit the place where, as Colette states, she spent a lot of her time growing up. Colette's second theory is one, again, we've covered on the show before, of shared generational entities. These figures that may haunt bloodlines, such as banshees, etc., and they often appear at times of illness or death, the same entities appearing in dreams, hallucinations, etc. In folklore, it is known, as Colette does put in her email, as a familial spirit or an ancestral echo, or an inherited haunting. Colette's final theory is that the entity was attached to a home or the land. As she states, it used to be a place, apparently, of Native American passing through or even burial. And as we've heard in plenty of experiences, occurrences begin when new owners of a property start to make renovations, start to disrupt the status quo. And Colette ends her final theory with something which leads me on to a potential fourth theory. She ends it with, sometimes the land itself is thought to hold spiritual energy, especially if there's a history connected to it, such as burial grounds or cultural disruption. And it's from that I could draw a fourth theory, which is plausible if we're taking into account that all of this can exist, of course. And that is, maybe the land which your grandfather's house was built on does have some spiritual energy. And if spirits, or even tulpas, feed off that energy, it would seem to make sense that the tulpas you created during your nighttime ritual would find your grandfather's home a more energetic place to be, somewhere they can more easily seep energy to maintain themselves. A place to leave you and to remain. You do state yourself that you stayed over at your grandparents quite a lot in your childhood. So I would imagine your nightly ritual also continued there. And if that's the case, as I say, it may be much easier for them to exist on a land with such spiritual energy. A truly fascinating aspect of your entire email, though, Colette, is the whole experiences from both you and your grandfather with the Hat Man, or in your grandfather's case, the Hat Woman. But whatever this entity is, it's so intriguing that you had no knowledge of this phenomena beforehand, and I would imagine your grandfather didn't either, unless he was deeply into the paranormal. Now, I've never personally heard of the Hat Man being an omen of death, or a psychopomp, so to speak. This is the first time I've heard it referenced in that way. But it strikes a chord, and this is something very strange that has happened to me as season 20 has gone on. I seem to be ending each episode I do, be it for Patreon or on the main feed, with a personal anecdote. But you mentioning that correlation of the Hat Man and death brings me back to a memory of my own. And it was more the mention of the trench coat that triggered the memory. Because when I was about 16, I had my mother and father come home from a night out. And it was raining outside very heavily, and I heard the front door open and close. I peeked over the banister and looked into the hallway, and in the hall was a man in a brimmed hat and a trench coat shaking the rain off himself. And he seemed to pause. I had stopped breathing at this point. I didn't want to be seen. He seemed to pause and almost look around as in to say, "I'm in the wrong house," and then left. And I checked through the window, but I couldn't see him. But in truth, it was literally sideways rain, and it was pitch dark outside. And it really shook me up, because I thought, I knew the door was unlocked. You could have opened it from outside, because back then, that's just how we had the house. But it really made me think we should start locking that door, because that man has just walked in. And I mentioned it to my mum and dad, and they were really took aback. And within a year, my mum passed away. Now, I've never, ever, previous to this day when I'm recording this episode, put those two things into any sort of causality. But this email has now got me thinking. And yes, I may be clutching at straws here, but it's an interesting thought, and it's definitely a very deeply intriguing thought to leave our final minisode on, that the Hat Man, who we have heard so much about throughout the entire existence of the dark paranormal, may be an omen of death. I wonder how many other people, like me, have not made a link between the witnessing of a hat silhouette man or woman and a following death within the next 12 months. So Colette, sincerely thank you for being our final minisode of this season and leaving us all with some serious paranormal food for thought. Don't forget, you only have till Friday midnight UK time to claim your free week of membership to our highest tier on Patreon. And for Dark Minisodes, I'll speak to you next time for our debut Dark Minisode of Season 21. And until then, stay safe and take care.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.